There are clear racial inequalities in our criminal justice system, but the causes of those inequities is not quite as clear. A new book explores the complexities of that. It's called Locking Up Our Own: Crime and Punishment in Black America. James Forman Jr. is a professor of law at Yale Law School. His father was a leader of SNCC, that's the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and James Jr. is a graduate of Atlanta's own Roosevelt High. He joins us in studio, and he'll speak at a Morehouse College conference later this morning. Welcome.
Thank you.
And let's start with your dad. One of the stories that he repeated often was after he got, after he left the Air Force, he was pulled over. He was studying. He was going to USC at the time, I think. He was studying late. He was pulled over by police because there had been a robbery and they said he was suspicious. He was apprehended anyway, arrested, I think. And he described that event as being so dramatic and traumatic, he had to seek therapy for it. And I wonder how much of your dad's experience ended up in your research for this book.
Well, I think a lot of it. I mean, his life, right? Your parents, they pass on their messages. They pass on their stories at the dinner table. And in one way, growing up in Atlanta, I had the benefit, and my generation had the benefit of the successes of his generation because, you know, we didn't necessarily have to deal with an all-white police force like the sort that he had to deal with growing up in Los Angeles. And we had opportunities, right? That generation, the civil rights generation, they made it possible for people of my generation to have access to jobs that were, you know, impossible to imagine to a black man of my dad's generation. But at the same time, I could still see a lot of those perpetuation of those policing practices that he had described. It's just that now it was more complicated because now we had a lot of African American officers, right? And growing up in Atlanta, we had a black police chief, we had a black mayor. But at the same time, there was a lot of really kind of damaging practices. And a lot of kids in my neighborhood grew up, you know, fearing the police. And so that's, I guess, some
both
of the complexity.
Both black and white.
Both black and white. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the issues of once upon a time, we thought in this country that if we integrated the police departments, that would change policing practices. Martin Luther King Sr. gave a speech at Morehouse College in 1941 when there were no black officers in Atlanta. And he said, 105,000 Negroes deserve one Negro police. And the belief was that when the force was integrated, that the practices would change in poor communities and black communities. And what we saw was we got the integration, which was great, which we need, which we deserve, but a lot of the practices continue.
And you actually start the book with a story of a judge, an actual African-American judge, lecturing a kid that you were defending about how he has just basically trashed the entire legacy of the civil rights movement. That event seemed to have made a huge impression upon you. Why?
Well, so Brandon had pled guilty to possession of a gun and possession of a small amount of marijuana. Right? He was facing sentencing in, as you said, with an African-American judge, and I was asking for him to be put on probation. And the judge not only didn't do that, the judge locked him up, but on the way to locking him up, he gave him this speech where he said, listen, Martin Luther King fought and died for your freedom. He fought and died for change in America, and his fight was not for you to be running and gunning and thugging and carrying on and carrying that gun. And so for me, somebody who had become a public defender because I viewed it as the civil rights issue of my generation, I viewed myself as carrying on my father's legacy, to go into court and have, you know, a black man representing a black client in front of a black judge and have that judge flip that civil rights history on its head and use it as a justification to lock up my client, I found incredibly demoralizing.
So I want to be clear to anyone who's listening that your book in no way claims that institutional racism is not a great deal at fault for their incarceration crisis in the United States, right?
That's absolutely right, and I'm glad you brought that up. No, I'm very clear throughout the book that structural and institutional racism has limited the options that were available to the African-American decision makers that I write about, right? I'm writing mainly about Black police chiefs, Black mayors, Black judges, Black police officers, but we don't operate in a vacuum, right? They operate within a structure. And so you see over and over again the way that racism limits their choices. They say, Black decision makers say, we want more police and we want more prosecutors, but we also want more jobs. We want more money for education. We want money for housing. We want national gun control. We want a Marshall Plan for urban America. We want the United States to invest in Black communities the way it invested in Europe after World War II. But Black leaders get none of that. For 50 years, they go to Congress asking for money for all of the above, and they come back for 50 years with money for one of the above, and the one of the above is law enforcement.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with James Forman Jr., a law school professor at Yale and author of Locking Up Our Own Crime and Punishment in Black America. And Professor Forman speaks at Morehouse College later this morning. So let's go back to the war on crime. And there are certain eras in law enforcement trends, I guess. The war on crime was one of them. Broken windows policy was another one. And you are very careful about tracing, about talking about the majority African-American communities who also were part enthusiastic partners in the war on crime. Why?
Folks were desperate. Folks were scared. People wanted protection. So the homicide rate in this country doubled in the 1960s. It tripled in D.C. It more than doubled in Atlanta. And then in the 80s, in the early 90s, we get the crack epidemic, right? Which a lot of Black leaders said, this is the worst thing to hit us since slavery. So when you have mothers who say, I can't take my kid to school because they're drug dealers on the corner, and I can't leave them in the park after school because they're selling drugs in the park and they're shooting in the park and I'm scared. And you have those folks reaching out to their elected officials, African-American elected officials in many cases in some of our big cities, and saying, we want protection. The response from the elected officials, people like Maynard Jackson here in Atlanta in the 1970s and 1980s, is to try to provide that protection. And they do it the only way they can, or the only way they know how, with their sort of limited imagination that we as Americans have about how to respond to crime. And that's through more aggressive policing. So the need for policing, right, the need for protection is present. It's just that the way we went about it was so damaging and so kind of over-aggressive that it's led to this thing that we now talk about as mass incarceration.
So one of the things I enjoy is that your book doesn't just tell us what all these problems are, but you have solutions for them. And a lot of them come from your years spent as a public defender in D.C. Give me an example of something that might make a change.
Well, the number one most important thing that we can do is economic, and it's jobs. And so I always tell, when I'm talking to a mayor, I'm talking to a governor, and they're talking about, well, we have a crime crisis in this particular community. And I say, and I'm saying this not facetiously, I say, instead of saturation policing, what if we tried saturation employment? What if we actually put everybody, business leaders, other people, community leaders, government leaders together, and we said, in this neighborhood, for the next 2 years, we are going to make it our goal to make sure that every single person in this neighborhood has a job. Like, let's actually try that as a solution. So that's one thing that we can do. We can also do things like, there are new programs that are alternatives to violence. Instead of just locking people up for long sentences, there's restorative justice, where you bring members of the community together, people that have been harmed and people that have harmed them. There's a program out of Brooklyn called Common Justice, which does this beautifully. And people sit down around a table and they talk about their shared pain. The person that committed the crime apologizes and they talk about the forces that helped drive them to it. And the person that was harmed gets not just prison sentence, not prison for the person that did it, but they actually get treatment. And they themselves, right, get trauma treatment. A lot of people that are victims of crime, the number one thing they want is they want somebody to address their trauma. And right now we don't do any of that. We just say prison for the perpetrator and everybody go home, as if that's supposed to solve the matter. And it doesn't.
So, you know, we had the beginnings of justice reform a few years ago, and some of that has been rolled back in recent years. What do you tell to lawmakers who at this very moment are probably considering some of these reforms and whether or not to move forward?
Well, it's been rolled back at the federal level, but what I always want to talk to people about is that 88% of prisoners in this country are in state, local, and county prisons, and 85% of law enforcement is state and local. So the federal government actually is a tiny part of the overall picture. And we've seen that in the last year, even as President Trump and Jeff Sessions, as you say, have kind of stepped back from the reform movement. In Louisiana, they just passed a massive overhaul of their criminal justice system that's going to make it much less punitive, and it's incredibly punitive. In Alabama, they just restored rights to citizens. Many citizens that have lost their right to vote had it restored, and that was 3 months ago. In Philadelphia, just last week, a very progressive, reform-oriented prosecutor who said, I'm not going to keep fighting the war on drugs, and I'm not going to seek the death penalty, and I'm not going to lock people up on unaffordable cash bail. He ran for the top prosecutor in the city. People thought it was a joke when he first announced, because his main background was suing police officers, and he won. So what I tell people is keep the focus on the local level. That's where we're going to continue to win the battle. And then eventually, hopefully, there'll be a change in the administration in D.C. and we can start to fight there.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but there has been some pushback on your book from people saying, why are you blaming the victims for what's happening with an African-American community?
Well, I don't think I am blaming the victims. In fact, I think in some ways my book shows how deeply entrenched structural and institutional racism have become in this country, that they have led us all in some ways to become more punitive. They've led us all in some ways to contribute to this. So my message to people is nobody is blameless. We all played a part.
That is Yale Law School Professor James Forman Jr. His book is called Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. It hit shelves in April, and James is speaking at Morehouse College a little later this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we hear music from Atlanta cellist Takanobu. First, though, look into the toxic world of coal ash that may be leaking into water. This is on Second Thought.